LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
The time is coming when the hooded man comes to the forest.
You were sleeping. You slept too long. We all have. It's time we woke. Time we stopped running.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Mark Olley, who joins us to discuss his book, The Life and Times of the Real Robin Hood, a detailed investigation of a character who represents resistance to powerful and corrupt authority the world over. Robin Hood is a heroic outlaw in English folklore who, according to legend, was a highly skilled archer and swordsman. Traditionally depicted as being dressed in Lincoln green, he is often portrayed as robbing from the rich and giving to the poor, alongside his band of merry men. He became a popular folk figure in the late medieval period and continues to be widely represented in literature, film, and television. Delving deep into the history and archaeology of people and places, we attempt to separate fact from fiction in the possible or probable lives of Robin and the familiar cast of characters such as Little John, Friar Tuck, Will Scarlet, Maid Marian, the Sheriff of Nottingham, and King Richard the Lionheart. Along the way, we visit locations such as Sherwood Forest and the city of Nottingham, exploring the momentous change, conflict, and power struggles of medieval England. Although Robin's true identity may never be known, the tale which emerges is every bit worthy of the high adventure and wild romance of a centuries-old legend that lives on to this very day.
This isn't an ordinary fight. Fight. This is a fight between the powers of light and darkness.
Hello and welcome, Mark, and thank you so much for joining us once again on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Always a pleasure.
Okay, Mark, today we're going to be talking about another one of your books, The Life and Times of the Real Robin Hood. As previously, before we dive into that, just tell listeners a little bit about your work and your background, and then how you came to produce this story. What was it that first gripped you about the Robin Hood tales?
Right. Well, I'm a historian, archaeologist, television presenter. I also write books. And my interest in Robin Hood really came from talking to a producer friend of mine about doing a documentary of some kind for release to video. So we had a list, we had a nice long list of different things to tackle, and he sort of lives up in Lancashire on the Yorkshire borders, and he said, oh, I'd really like to tackle Robin Hood. I don't think anyone's ever done Robin Hood properly before. So I said, oh, okay, we'll do that. And then, of course, I went into meltdown because I'd got plenty of notes and some ideas and a few bits of research I'd picked up over the years. And I thought, don't know whether I've got enough here for a documentary, but I'll have a go at it. So we sort of notionally set aside a couple of years to work it through to get it to production standard. But as a book, it's sort of written as a commission because he just said, well, put it all together and see how it comes out. So I got stuck in. I'd already got the book on the Ninth Legion out by this point, and the publisher said, oh yeah, Robin Hood, yeah, we'd like a go at that, and that sounds like a good idea. So I thought, oh okay, I've got a producer for a DVD, and I've got a publisher for a book. So the total project, to get it from start to finish, to finish it all off, took about 4 years in total, which was about a year or so of research on my part, before approaching the producer, and then from the producer and the publisher saying, yes, we're interested, we can do something with this, it then took about 2 years to produce something close to a final draft of a documentary script and a book, and then it took us another year to get the book finally into print and to get the DVD finally on release. So we actually have the life and times of the real Robin Hood now as a DVD and a book. And the way I tend to look at it is that the book tells you what and the DVD tells you where. So if you want to really get the full story of what we did over that four-year period, that's the thing to do. And on the DVD it's interesting because we've got quite a large making of section as well, so you can actually see how we plodded around the various sites and how we put the whole thing together. So really it's kind of a three for one, I suppose. You've got the making of, you've got the documentary, which is over an hour long, hour and 20 minutes, and you've got the book, which I think is pretty good actually. It's come out all right, I'm quite pleased with it.
Now, the tale of Robin Hood and exploits of his merry men is kind of one of the great kind of heroic, romantic sort of stories out there. In terms of a plot and characters, it's one of those things that you kind of say it's got it all. Certainly from the point of view of a fiction writer or a movie producer, you know, which is where a lot of where a lot of people first come into contact with, you know, the stories about Robin Hood is in some kind of pop culture format. I mean, you just you've told us, you know, about how this the book and the DVD came together. Just you as a person, I mean, was it in childhood? Do you have an early memory of seeing a picture of Robin Hood, or maybe reading a storybook, or seeing something on TV? Maybe it was Errol Flynn, or for my part, it was the 1980s Robin of Sherwood TV series. Now,
I think for most people, it is.
Yeah, I mean, previous to that, I'd heard of Robin Hood, of course, you know. And I'd probably seen a picture, you know, a movie still of Errol Flynn with his silly little hat on or whatever.
Men in Tights, I think everybody has.
But so for me it was the 1980s one. But so when was that first happened for you?
I think it was the 1980s one for me. I've got to say I preferred the chap with the dark hair to the chap with the blonde hair.
You had Michael Praed was the actual. He was replaced by Jason Connery, but that wasn't a success, you know.
No, I think the first two series were absolutely superb. No, the way I came first in contact with that was that many years ago, turn the clock back, I don't know, 20-odd years ago or whatever, the series was filmed, it was in the can, they'd done it. I think it was the 1990s, late 1990s. I went to do a clearance on a chap that was selling a load of old props, and I actually picked up one of the Robin of Sherwood swords that was used in the series, which ironically I now carry as my own sword when I do medieval reenactment. So I'm wandering around with this, you know, season one and two Robin of Sherwood prop, which is the sword. It is a prop sword. I mean, it's pretty nasty on the blade, but the design of it's very, very good. And that's what's actually ended up appearing on the DVD and on the book cover. That is actually the Richard Carpenter Robin of Sherwood. It's one of the prop swords. So that was how I came to that, apart from watching on television like everybody else, of course. And it kind of inspired me. And after that, it's more as a historian, because as you say, you can't float into the world of history without bumping into certain characters. You know, you sort of fall over Alfred the Great and you bump into Hereward the Wake, and, you know, you've got Lady Godiva riding a horse and this, that and the other. All these characters sort of jump at you out of history. But again, there are some giants like, you know, Richard Lionheart, Robin Hood, you know, the Wicked Prince John. Like you say, it's got it all, so it's unavoidable. But the thing that inspired me was having seen all of these different aspects of Robin Hood, which I suppose they all are, and having watched that first series, I sort of thought, well, hang on a minute, there's got to be something behind all of this. You know, it doesn't suddenly appear on the stage of history from nowhere. You know, even Shakespeare name checks Robin Hood. So there's got to be something in this that goes back a lot further than you know, modern media would perhaps lead us to believe. So I just thought, right, that's it. Let's get stuck in and try and find out what the truth is. And I had lots of surprises, which are all, of course, in the book.
I think one thing to put to bed straight away, and funny enough, just as I was this very morning, I wasn't doing anything related to Robin Hood research or anything, but there was just a story that came to my attention just when I was looking at a roundup of news, you know, online, and something referenced Robin Hood. It was to do with places. I think it was actually related to Sherwood Forest and a forestry story, and it mentioned Robin Hood inevitably, as it would. And but one of the things that came out from this news story was saying, you know, that for many people, they sort of assume that the Robin Hood story is entirely mythical. It's kind of like, yeah, it's got no basis whatsoever in history. But actually, it's the almost complete opposite is true. That's the, this has certainly got basis in history. It's just a question of what we can now unpick about it. You know, was Robin Hood one person, or where was he, or what, you know, what was his actual name and status, and what did he actually do? But the idea that there never ever was a Robin Hood, or, you know, direct equivalent, you know, we, I think we can forget about that.
Oh no, there's no doubt that he exists. I worked on some of the physical aspects of the Robin Hood story with a friend of mine who's a landscape archaeologist, and he's nothing to do with mythology, nothing to do with religion. His background is computer programming with IBM. He's, you know, it's a shoot-it's-a-duck kind of approach. He does landscape using satellites. It's quite a modern-day thing. He, you know, flies over sites using LiDAR, using Google Earth, using all sorts of different things, and goes and searches for things. So I gave him a simple task, and I just said, well, you know, here's the Robin Hood manuscript, go and see what you can find, see what's out there. Gave him a list of locations I wanted him to have a look at. After a while, both of us had a meeting, and it was one of those funny things where you go into a room and you sit there and you both kind of sat there looking at each other with sort of knowing looks on your face, but you're not quite sure where to jump in. And he sort of jumped in first, and he went, well, I've not found Robin Hood, but I found where he should be. And I sort of looked at him and I said, I know exactly what you mean, because it's like a jigsaw puzzle with a piece missing. And that piece in the middle is Robin Hood. It's the man himself, the character himself. And he's there in the documents, he's there in the geography, he's there in the locations, he's there in the legends. You can see the shape of this jigsaw puzzle. You can see all the pieces around him. So you know who's talking to him, you know who his bosses are, you know who his commanding officers are, where he sits in the social structure. You can see the geography, you know where he is, you know all the different players in the story and the people, and you can kind of locate all these things, but actually trying to nail that missing piece. We sat there staring at each other across the room, and it was a case of, damn it, we know it's there. We know he's there. We can see he's there. He has to be there. History at this time doesn't work unless he's there to be a part of this story. But like you say, trying to actually nail the man himself, I think records-wise, I think we've managed to find probably a dozen entries of one sort or another which we could ascribe directly to him as a character in history. But considering how superbly important he was and how enormously, you know, famous he's become and gigantic as a character, in his own time, both of us felt we were trying to pin down an ordinary bloke, which, as anybody involved in history, archaeology, anything like that would know, is virtually an impossible task at such a, you know, a huge distance in time. 700 or 800 years later, it's difficult to actually pin down an individual person in records and things like that. But as far as this material that's available to fill that missing piece in, I think we managed to find sufficient of it to make the book, you know, certainly proof-wise, it's big enough to say, yes, there is a Robin Hood. Absolutely.
Okay, well, perhaps for those who are not familiar with the period in time that we're talking about, we should set the wider historical scene. So whether or not Jesus Christ ever lived, I always find I always find the 2,000-year thing that we're gradually moving away from now. But, you know, we have the time of Christ through to roughly the present day, about 2,000 years, and it can be really useful in people's minds to say where this is in all of that. So we find ourselves in England at more or less the overlap between the Anglo-Saxon and the Norman period is what we're really talking about.
slightly later than that. You're pretty much into the start of the Crusades. So you're about 100, 150 years after 1066.
Okay.
Maybe 100 years after.
Yeah, I suppose it depends on how much you consider that an Anglo-Saxon influence dragged on, or...
Well, yeah, I mean, the Saxons, I don't suppose they ever went away, so in that sense, yeah.
Okay, well then, just give people, a flavour of the historical scene that we're talking about, and, you know, some, just so people get a handle on it. I mean, 1066, obviously, as you say, it's some considerable time after that, but just so people can begin to sort of... imagine you were like, this is the opening scenes of a Robin Hood movie, and you just, you know, what would people see? You know, what would life in England be like?
Actually, the movies, some of the movies are pretty accurate. The idea of sort of early to middle medieval, where you've got your knights, your crusader knights, sort of second, third crusade period, the sort of classic medieval view of things is where you are. I mean, I can throw some dates in. I suppose that might be helpful for people. Going through the records, we managed to discover that he was more than likely born probably in the winter of 1129 going into 1130. So he's, you know, he's fairly early in that century, but he does live a long time because of his position, because he's a forester and he's got access to, you know, the best sort of food, the best environment. He's a very physical person. Obviously, he starts off as an archer and develops into a knight himself. He actually lives to quite a ripe old age. I think we're going to about 86 to 88 years of age, which means there isn't one particular king. There's actually five kings on the throne during his lifetime. I suppose his tales, the famous stories, really begin... probably around about the 1145, 1146. That's when he starts off with his first tales. Then, of course, I suppose by the time he's at his high point, the sort of high point of his fame, is when he is actually an outlaw and he's sort of pestering various different sides in the conflict over Sherwood Forest and sort of King John versus Richard the Lionheart, that whole thing going on. I mean, Richard the Lionheart is all in the 1190s, so you're at the end of that era. King John then kind of tips over. King John then tips into the beginning of the 1200s. There's a very, very, very strong possibility that the entourage that went down to the signing of Magna Carta, the Northern Barons, etc., there's a good possibility Robin was involved in that, which, of course, was 1215. So then we think then that he probably then passed away somewhere around about 1217. So Magna Carta and the barons trying to force King John into, you know, giving them some rights and what have you. He's involved in that. That, I suppose, that you could say was the ultimate outcome of everything that he'd lived through the troubled times. And he does, as his life goes on, he kind of changes. Various times he's an outlaw and at various times he's not. The whole concept from the story that sometimes he's serving the ruling monarch, which was the wicked King John, other times he's standing up for Richard the Lionheart and Richard's side, that idea is true. That is basically how it was. So yeah, if you think of days of when the timber castles are being built into stone and the whole thing that you get with that Richard the Lionheart thing and everything, that's the period we're in. That's the colours that we're painting with.
Just talking about the nature of his life, his background, his origins and everything else, my conception, which is probably the popular one, of the idea of Robin Hood, was someone who was from lowly origins. The fact that he ended up living in the woods, finding his way, and they always seemed to be pitted against people who were in powerful positions and living, you know, high in the hog in castles and what have you. And he was a sort of man of the people type thing. And this is sort of gives the lie, really, to this picture of him. As you say, a forester, eventually a knight himself, you know, with these elite connections. And yes, he may have fallen foul of the establishment, in all the sort of shenanigans and power games going on over time. But it made me think that in some ways, well, yeah, I mean, if he really had just been a peasant, what would he have needed to have done with his life in order to end up in a historical record like this? I thought there was, surely there was a period in time when really only, or almost only the, deeds or the writings or the doings or whatever of people at the higher end of society would end up being recorded or spoken of.
Well, what you're saying is true, in that the idea that Robin came from a lowly background depends on how you view his background. He's of noble lineage, okay, but his mum was married to a noble who died and then remarried in slightly later in her life to a forester. A forester is not a peasant. He's actually sort of lower nobility, almost. He's got tremendous responsibility. And what happens is when Robin is born, the forester, for some reason, then also passes away. We think his name was Udard or Utard the forester. He dies when Robin's quite young. There was a very popular Forester's manuscript records a very popular rhyme. And in the rhyme it says, Randolph kept Robin 15 winters till he was 15 years old. So what we think happens is that when Udard dies, he's then adopted by the previous family that his mother was married into, who turns out to be the nobles of Chester. So the Randolph is Ranulf. We think it's Earl Ranulf de Gernon of Chester, and it's his household that takes Robin in, which kind of then gets us around a couple of the other associations, because there's a very famous rhyme that refers to Robin, and it appears in Langland's Piers Plowman, which was written about 1362. And it's a character that's talking, and this character actually says, I can't recite my paternoster, which are prayers, perfectly as the priest sings them, but I can sing rhymes of Robin Hood and Ranulf Earl of Chester. And that's the first time these rhymes of Robin Hood are mentioned, back in 1362. It's the first time it appears anywhere in writing. But the rhymes are directly linked to Ranulf Earl of Chester. So it appears that it's something to do with the material associated with Chester. You've also got this idea that Ranulf then adopts Robin and keeps him till he was 15 years old. So he's there till at least his 16th birthday as, presumably, a page. He's adopted. I mean, illegitimate children and children that are off to one side of nobility, when the heirs were thin on the ground, were very often pulled into noble families to bolster the male stock. And that's kind of what's happening with Robin. He's kind of, sort of noble descent. So he kind of gets sucked into this whole thing that's going on in Chester. So he can't rise up to become a noble, you know, he can't become a noble himself, but he can get very close to becoming a noble by becoming a knight. And that's what we think actually happens. We think he climbs a very well-ploughed tree branch, if you like, a well-ploughed furrow. He climbs it in such a way that he starts off as a page or as an adopted son, where he's trained with Randolph Earl of Chester. Then once he has trained, he then goes off to do his military service up around Scarborough and Whitby, up in that area, mainly because one of the families he's associated with is the O'Malley family, and they have lands and what have you up there, and they're building Scarborough Castle, so he goes up there. And then when he comes back again, when he comes back to Chester, he's then qualified then to become a junior forester, because he knows then how to fight with a sword, fight with a staff, fight with a bow, which he's extremely good at, apparently. And then he ploughs that furrow. He goes forester, and he rises up through the ranks till eventually he becomes sort of a lesser knight, if you like. Then he bumps into Richard, King Richard, who then knights him for his loyalty. So he then jumps, makes a huge leap then from forester into being a knight. And then that explains how he gets away with so much, because he literally gets away with murder. He's acting then how can I put it? A sort of a royal appointed forester knight. And that's not unheard of. We've got, you know, loads and loads of burials of forester knights all over Derbyshire, Staffordshire, Yorkshire, Lancashire, Cheshire. Wherever there was woodland, you find these forester knight burials where you've got the knight's tombstone with a cross with a sword on it. And very often on the side, you've got a bow or you've got a forester's cap or one of the other things associated with forestry. Green men tend to turn up. So you know that these people existed. And then eventually he is kind of out there with the nobles when they all go down to sort out Magna Carta. So really he's not he's not a peasant, and he's not a Saxon. He's half Briton, half whatever the Britons were, and then half claiming ancestry from the Normans. So he's actually a mixture of the two. He bridges the two. And he is climbing. You know, he has very lowly beginnings as a page boy in Chester, and he is a social climber as such, but not from a position of poverty. He's climbing from a position of reasonable strength, actually, so he arrives at the position where he can then make a difference in his older life. In fact, at the very end, he actually chooses to become a hermit. He just kind of goes, oh, you know, blow it, I'm not doing this anymore, I'm going to retire. And he goes off to a hermitage in an abbey, where they then have to call him back to go and help out with Magna Carta, because his job isn't completely finished. And then he more than likely passes away at an abbey in the end, so he chooses a religious life as he gets older.
We won't bury him just yet, but...
No. If we could just... There's a bit more before that.
Yes, but... So how does the... it all sounds quite rosy in the garden for him, so how does he fall foul of the establishment and end up in the position of outlaw? You know, what, in terms of the politics and the power games there, you know, how does he end up? Well, it depends what you think of as the wrong side, but certainly, you know, he ends up having to take a step out of that, you know, what looks like a fairly easy ascension through the social ranks.
Well, we kind of did this in the DVD in quite a nifty way, because we do it on screen as two. We look at the country and we kind of divide the country into sections. Because you've got two sides, really. You've got the Richard the Lionheart side, which we took to calling the Red Team. And the Red Team really have everything north of the River Trent all the way up to Scotland. They're all supporters of Richard the Lionheart, so they really are the Red Team. If you go below the River Trent, historically, we noticed that there was a lot of agreements between John and Richard, and John's supporters and Richard's supporters, that John wouldn't actually cross the Trent. He wouldn't come north and dispossess the barons. He actually said, no, obviously, I'll leave them alone. He didn't in the end, but that in essence was what was going on. So going south, you tend to get the Blue Team, and they've got a very continental outlook. They're almost dovetailed into northern France. So you've got Blues going down, Reds going up, but then if you go right the way up into Scotland, you've got this other team which is up there, which is under the Scottish rulership, and we call that the Yellow Team. So essentially it's Reds versus Blues, with the Yellows sort of poking the nose in from time to time, and they actually poke the nose in all the way down, almost as far as the Trent themselves. So you've got Scots interfering as well, especially on the east coast and down the middle. And then right smack bang in the middle, where all of these people come together. So you're looking now sort of Herefordshire, Staffordshire, Cheshire, going then across, you've got your Nottinghamshire, and then it swings up the Trent Valley and it goes up into South Yorkshire. The whole of this area, which is basically a border zone, that's where Robin and his men are operating. So then when you put that in perspective, you start to see that actually it's these two teams, Red versus Blue, depends who's in favour. So all the Red supporters are cheering Robin on, and it's like, you know, go, go. And all the Blue supporters are sort of, you know, boo the villain, because we can't get anywhere where we want to go north of the Trent. And that then is actually the backstory to this idea of robbing the rich and giving to the poor. Every time the Blue Team sets foot north of the Trent, they get clobbered. Basically, the Green Team, which is Robin's lot, they jump in and they steal from anyone who's a sympathiser to John. So what you've got is, you say, it depends who's in power as to who favours Robin and who doesn't favour Robin. And it's interesting, actually, because that helps us to work out some of the history, depending on which side the viewpoint was coming from. The Red Team absolutely loved him to bits. The Blue Team seemed to absolutely hate him to bits because he stole everything from them. And the Scots just didn't really have an opinion. They were completely flat on the matter. They actually do write quite a lot about Robin Hood, and they just call him that outlaw or that famous person. They don't really have any opinion. They just leave it at face value, which is quite interesting. But that's kind of what we came up with. So, like you say, it depends on who's looking at it as to what standpoint you get.
So what was going on with the kings then, like John and Richard, as you say, so-called Lionheart, because I wondered that out, thinking back to watching the the TV series again. And, you know, as you say, you had portrayed as evil King John, and then you had, you know, heroic Richard, you know, which is a bit of a simplistic view of these two individuals.
Well, it's also a bit wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
As we looked into the history more and more, we started thinking, hang on a minute, you've got this famous King Richard the Lionheart, and all he wants to do is go off to war. He was only in this country 7 months, because he only visited here twice. Once was for 3 months, and once was for 2 months, and that's when he bumped into Robin. But he was only here for a very short period of time, and he cost us an absolute fortune. He bled the country dry of money, because he was always away on crusade and always needed things paying for. And then you've got this other guy, who's his younger brother, this wicked King John, who started off as a tax collector. Now, who likes tax collectors? Nobody likes tax collectors. But the taxes that John was collecting was actually largely to subsidise Richard, because Richard had bankrupted the country by not being here and spending the money elsewhere. So then obviously when Richard's out of the picture, poor old King John's left with this country that's just been rubbished. It's, you know, absolutely bled dry. He then has to somehow come up with a way of making the country work, which is a little bit similar to the austerity measures that we've got now. Nothing's popular and the people really don't like what he's doing, but it's a kind of a necessary evil. Without it happening, you know, it nothing is going to work. The country isn't going to survive. You know, it couldn't defend itself, it couldn't run economically. But people on the ground, you see, didn't sort of see it that way. But as we started looking more and more into it, we started thinking, you know, Richard, you know, didn't really run things the way he was supposed to run things. And because John did, and he kind of ran it to the letter of the law, everybody hated him for it, which is a bit of a shame, really. But I hope that comes out in the documentary, because that was something we were aiming for. Was to kind of show that they weren't quite the people they were made out to be.
With that in mind, maybe we should look at some of the cast of popular characters that are presented to us in the, I say fictionalised, you know, the dramatised versions of the Robin Hood story. And we're thinking of like Little John and Friar Tuck and Maid Marian, of course, and the, you know, the evil Sheriff of Nottingham and all the rest of it. So, I mean, just pluck who you like from the usual suspects and, you know, maybe just give people a flavour of what we know or what we can speculate about who these people might have been. You know, are some of them amalgams of various characters or...
Well, some of them are there in history, okay? Maybe not quite as prominently as they're put forward in the movies, but they definitely exist. I mean, the one that's not there, which is a shame, because I used to like him in the Disney cartoon Robin Hood, was Alan O'Dale, which was the cockerel, the minstrel. He's been pinched, and he's come in from somewhere else. He's come from another story altogether. So when you go back to the original stories, there is no Alan O'Dale. He's not there. Little John Little, he's a sort of, how can I put it, he's a Derbyshire lad. His family origins are all in Derbyshire. But he does end up in Nottingham, and he actually spends a year as a yeoman in the service of the Sheriff of Nottingham. So Little John, he's referred to as Robin Hood's general. So he has some position. He probably is either similar to Robin in terms of a page making his way up, or by the time they all get together, he's a knight. He's something to do with nobility, is John. Will Scarlet's an interesting one, and possibly another character called William Scathelock, and the two tend to get mixed up, but Scarlet means red, and Scathelock means lock smasher, so they're actually two different characters. They both come from Macclesfield, and they're both supposed to be brothers, okay, so that's worth remembering. There's a guy called Georgia Green, who kept the livestock compound at Wakefield. Little Much, the miller's son, Gilbert Whitehand, Good Reynolds, the sheriff's cook, who was the sheriff's cook of Nottingham. He actually leaves the sheriff's service and joins the outlaws. And then depending on who you read, there's 70 to 110 archers in amongst his band. So the number of archers that he has under his command vary from time to time. Then you've got a guy called Arthur Bland, who was a Nottingham tanner. He joined them. And he was a relative of Little John's mother. And then you've got Friar or Father Tuck, which is, we make a joke about this in the DVD, because Tutbury, where he comes from, used to be known as Titbury. So we're quite pleased he changed it to Tutbury. Otherwise, he'd be quite a different friar than the one he is. We also managed to track him down in the records, and his first name was Roger. So he was friar or father, Sir Roger Tuck, or Tut of Tutbury. Maid Marian, we found a family called Marmion, who live adjacent to where Robin grew up, Loxley in Staffordshire. She's Maid Marmion, the Marmion family, and they are actually nobles. And I think they grew up sort of next door to each other. They were actually, they grew up as children, knew each other from that, and then only got together actually in later life. There's a twist there as well, because he does have her as a sort of a, how can I put it, the damsel in the tower, you know, the unreachable, the untouchable maiden, the medieval lady. And he tends to keep her as that for as long as he possibly can, which is something that the knights did. It's courtly love. It's all part of the tradition of courtly love. So although they actually end up with a daughter and a son, they don't get married till probably about 10 years after that happens. They get married right at the very end, so it's kind of love from afar. So the stories have got some of it true. And they get married at a place called Doveridge, very close to Tutbury and Loxley in Staffordshire. One thing that might inform you a little bit as well was one of the things we got from the records. There was a guy, the poet laureate Skelton, who was commissioned by Henry VIII to write a play about Robin Hood. Now, Henry VIII dissolved a lot of libraries and monasteries, so we lost an awful lot of records. So Skelton was in a position to then go look at records that we no longer have. And he wrote this play to be performed to Henry, and he called it The Downfall of the Earl of Huntingdon, which is actually a mistake because it was one of Robin's relatives that was the Earl of Huntingdon, not Robin, but that gets corrected in the book. But Henry VIII is quite well read and quite well informed himself, so Skelton had to really do his homework and do a lot of research. And I sort of made a list in the book of things that Skelton mentions back in 1509. So I'll read some of this out to you. These are the things he mentions. He mentions Sherwood, Barnsdale Shrogs, Nottingham Red Cliffs, Blythe and Tickhill, which are all different places, locations. Blythe and Tickhill is where Robin entertained his guests in inverted commas. So obviously they had a base somewhere in the Blythe and Tickhill area of southern Yorkshire. He mentions Bradford as Georgia Green's home. Wakefield is the home of a guy known as the Pinner. Barnsley is home of a guy known as the Potter, who appears in a lot of the early legends. Farmsfield is where the nuns supplied napkin shirts and bands to the outlaws. Kendal is where Bateman supplied Kendal green cloth. So actually, they don't wear Lincoln green. They wear Kendal green. It's dyed up in Kendal, up in Cumbria, using copper to produce the clothing. Leeds is where Sharp supplied the arrows. Rotherham was where Jackson the Bowmaker lived. And Mansfield is where Scarlett and Scathelock won a wrestling match. So they're all sort of incidental references from that play. But let's face it, you're talking about northerners. You know, it's undeniable that all of these characters and everything they're getting is all up here in the north. So it's really helpful to nail down the geography of the early tales. Absolutely phenomenal geography in that.
Okay, well, yeah, you mentioned a whole bunch of locations associated with the legends and the tales. There's a couple of others that I'll throw in. Before I do that, I will just say, before I forget, that I had this wonderful synchronicity just last week when I was finishing off reading your book, and the first reference to St. Mary's Abbey in York,
yep,
which has its own little bit part apparently in the story, when I was reading your book, I actually had it in my hand, and I was sitting right at the top of the central tower in York Minster, which is the highest point in York. And
wow.
You can see for about, on a clear day, you can see for about 40 miles. And I was reading down the page, and it was like St. Mary's Abbey in York. And I thought, oh, of course, wow. So I was able to, stand up, look over the edge of the wall, look down, and in the, down there, you know, hundreds of feet below, was the ruins of St. Mary's Abbey. And it was just kind of, you know, which I'd been around a few times over the years, but I didn't realize really what the significance of the place was. And I thought, oh wow, it's just amazing to think that that pile of, you know, stone down there that I'm looking at now, that ruin, might have had some little bit part in this story. So it was just kind of like, what are the chances of that happening at that point in time? But
it does have a connection. There's even a possibility that one of the abbots or priors of the abbey might have had a sort of loose family connection to Robin. Certainly a lot of the money that Robin stole originated from York. He certainly took a lot of money from there, which then it's this West Coast, East Coast thing where you've got the West Coast supporting the Red Team and the East Coast essentially supporting the Blue Team. Quite large areas of Yorkshire were sort of, you know, sympathisers with John, or certainly they towed the party line anyway as far as when John became a king. But Robin then seems to have taken great pleasure in, you know, taking pot shots at the monks and abbots from York.
I suppose the key location really in people's minds is that of Sherwood Forest, you know, in the fictionalized accounts or dramatized accounts where all the action takes place, more or less. And of course, the Sherwood Forest is real enough. It's still there today, but it's possible that the Sherwood that's there today wasn't the location for some of the historical events that we're talking about. You can perhaps shed a bit more light on this. But of course, as these things tend to go, if you go to what's left of Sherwood Forest these days, which is actually just about just over 1,000 acres, which really in terms of forestation you would have had in Britain in centuries gone by, I mean, that's nothing. I mean, that's absolutely nothing. But of course, if you do visit there today, you'll find your visitor centre, no doubt your Robin Hood merchandise by the bucket load. And they have a Robin Hood festival down there every year. And why not, I suppose? It's inextricably linked with the legend. So, of course, they're going to cash in on it. But perhaps you could say something about the geographically, you know, how that the reality might, you know, overlap or not with all of that.
It kind of does overlap, actually. I can't rule Sherwood out completely, not by any means. What Robin seems to have done is he seems to have taken an interest in what used to be known as the Great North Road, which basically now is it's the A1. That's the Great North Road. And that comes up one side of the old Sherwood Forest. But at the same time, Sherwood used to stretch up that road a lot higher than he does today. In fact, it used to continuously follow the road all the way up into South Yorkshire. So Barnsdale, which is the area in the old legends mostly associated with Robin, was actually connected to the Sherwood that we still have today. The reason Nottinghamshire generally claims Robin as their own is more or less to do with the castle. So Sherwood Forest surrounding Nottingham, the two are sort of intrinsic to each other. But he didn't spend as much time, Robin, at the castle as you might imagine. Sometimes the castle was owned by supporters of Richard, and sometimes it was owned by supporters of John. And what Robin tended to do was to get involved if it was somebody supporting John that controlled the castle. Obviously, at that point, you would then have, you know, the forces and administrators of the law based at the castle. They would be very interested in getting hold of Robin and sort of disposing of him. We know at least one sheriff was bumped off by Robin, because there's an early story where he either kills him with a sword and chops his head off, or shoots him with an arrow and chops his head off. And that takes care of one of the sheriffs. And then we also know that Little John takes out at least another sheriff at some point. But we know, by looking at the chronology of sheriffs, which we know were in power from Nottingham Castle at various times, we can pick out pretty much which ones were taken out and which ones were supported, because in turn they supported Richard. In fact, Richard, when he was here the second time, marched all the way to Nottingham and took the castle back, because that's when he gets to meet Robin. That's the famous incident at the Old Trip to Jerusalem pub, which is supposed to be where they met up and where King Richard knights him. So Nottingham and Sherwood have got a claim. There's absolutely no doubt about it. You know, folks need to know that this book doesn't sort of, you know, bash Nottingham or bash Sherwood in any way. It's just that the scene that was set at that time, at that period in history, was much bigger. It's huge. Sherwood, they as well went south. It stretched all down the River Trent and There was just a huge swathe of forest, if you like, that was this no man's land between Richard and John. So no, Sherwood has definitely got a claim, except perhaps the Great Oak, because when we did the documentary and sort of went and chatted to folks, the Great Oak would have been a shoot about an inch high out of an acorn when Robin was there. So it might be an acorn from the oak tree up which Robin hid, but that Great Oak is not the tree that he hid up, because if he hid up it, he would have squashed it.
Well, when you're at the at Sherwood Forest today, the Great Oak, I think they're frantically trying to keep it propped up with scaffolding.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So it's interesting you mentioned your old trip to Jerusalem pub, because, of course, you can still... that's still there today in Nottingham. And it claims boldly on its website that it is the oldest inn in England. But, of course, so too do another selection of inns in England claim to be the oldest. And apparently, I was asking around, and there isn't actually any concrete evidence that the current building, the old Trip to Jerusalem, yeah, you know, could be any part of it, could be anything like as old as that. I mean, I think they're looking at about... 1799 or something, I think, about the oldest part they can find. But it doesn't mean there wasn't something on that site, of course.
No,
you know.
No, it depends who you speak to. The claim is based on the archaeological presumption that the site, especially the cave in which that pub is slotted in, was in fact the brew house. That in fact the brew house was outside the castle walls, which is perhaps where you would expect it to be, and that the monks were actually sort of on that site brewing all the way back to the time of Richard and Robin. So the claim, I don't think, is based on the current standing structure. It's based on the site itself, the actual position of the pub. So maybe there is something in that, I don't know. Obviously, we've looked at various archaeologists who've gone in, and the opinions are split, I think is perhaps the safest way of putting it, as to whether that's the site of the brew house or not. In the documentary, we go with it. We actually say we think it probably was the brew house, and chances are, if Richard met with Robin, it probably was outside the walls. I wouldn't think they would necessarily have had their meeting inside the castle. So, yeah, possible. Possible. I wouldn't rule it out.
Once again, before I forget, I will just throw in a little bit of a little nugget of information that came my way just today, by the way, because I was talking about Robin Hood with some colleagues this morning, because I was, you know, knew I was going to be speaking with you this evening. And apparently, we think of, you know, Robin Hood and Little John fighting with staffs in an early meeting. This is something, again, that you quite often will see portrayed in on TV and the movies.
Yeah, the famous battle over the stream.
That's right. And a colleague told me today that she was reading something about a period in time, probably this medieval period, when a lot of us might have assumed that people who were being killed, whether, you know, in sort of like fights, disputes, or maybe even just murdered, were dying by the sword. And it just would fit with most people's ideas. But apparently I was informed today that people being killed by quarterstaffs was just the most common cause of that sort of death, you know, death by a weapon, as it were, and that made me reflect. And I suppose I thought, well, yeah, it'd be cheaper, it would require less maintenance, you know, maybe having a sword was a bit of a prestige item for most people. And as far as today's security-minded culture goes, well, you know, a staff is a walking stick as well as a weapon, whereas a sword is, you know, a sword is a sword is a sword, you know.
Well, this was an interesting thing that came out of the research. We know that most people, men and women in medieval times, carried knives of different sizes. And in the tales, they do mention this. There's the Saxon knife, the sea axe, is mentioned a couple of times in the original tales, not carried by Robin, though. The more you start to look at the original tales, though, that battle, that quarterstaff battle, is a later addition. It doesn't appear in the early tales at all. However, they do seem to fight an awful lot with swords, which, as you've rightly pointed out, if you were an ordinary man in the street, you know, you'd expect to either have a big scrap and somebody gets stabbed with a knife, which is what you'd expect to happen, or two people would have a scrap and they'd do it using quarterstaffs. Because, as you say, quarterstaffs were, you know, takers of lives back then, and people really knew how to fight with the staff. That was a Viking martial art called Starve, which they used to use purely to fight using quarterstaffs. But when you go back to the original legends, surprisingly, you discover that Robin and his men, sort of 85% of the time, are fighting with swords, which then again points to the fact that they must have been lesser nobles, because you obviously need money. It costs you 3 years' peasant wages to buy a sword, assuming you didn't spend it on anything else. So they can obviously afford the weapon, and they know how to use that as a weapon as well. They know how to fight with it. So yeah, that points towards the more of a gathering of nobles and lesser nobles than to peasants and purely foresters. Although foresters do carry swords as well, because they're representatives of the crown.
Well, you mentioned Magna Carta. This is obviously something, a well-documented period in time leading up to that event, the signing of it. I wonder, are there any other historical events or items on a timeline that are, you know, widely accepted that you can point to, that you can tie Robin or those associated with him into, as it were, just to hang the story a bit more on accepted history?
That's a difficult one, because at the end of the day, he's a northern lad. So you've then got to appeal to northern history, which is lesser known nationally than some of the big national events. The earliest thing I can think I can tie him into is the building of Scarborough Castle in stone. And when they actually start to construct the castle, Robin actually captures a ship out in the bay, and the money that he gets from capturing the ship, he decides he's going to sponsor a chapel outside the building of the castle. So you've then got the castle going up with its own private chapel, and then you've got this other chapel going up, which it's a chapel at a little village called Raw, R-A-W. It was the chapel that he built there. So you could say, okay, that's a point in history, building a Scarborough Castle. That's sort of fairly early on. That's in his childhood. So that's probably when he's around 16, 17, 18. He's doing his military training. He's left Chester. There are then quite a few conflicts up here in the north, northern rebellions with barons and various different people that he's involved in through the O'Malley family, so you can tie him into the O'Malleys. And then eventually he ends up as this character at Nottingham. So, as I say, I'm not going to give too much away because people won't buy the book otherwise, but we have a full list of sheriffs of Nottingham, and all the little stories and little incidents that happen with him around the Nottingham area, you can tie them into actual dates of real sheriffs who genuinely existed at Nottingham Castle at that time. So we can timeline him, and that carries you pretty much right through the 1100s and into the 1200s. You can see what he's doing and why based on the sheriffs. So that helps. Then you've got the Crusades. You can't really avoid the Crusades. You've got Richard the Lionheart. That's a national thing, obviously. You know, you've got your dates surrounding Richard. That ties in quite nicely. Richard's coronation was in 1189, so we know that Robin was definitely around at that time. The Scots mentioned that he was around for about 13 or 14 years after Richard was captured. So when Richard gets captured, when he's out on crusade, we know we've got sort of a timeline developing there. And then after that, you've got Richard coming across to this country, visiting this country, going up to Nottingham Castle, 1194. Then King Richard in 1199 gets killed by crossbow while he's besieging Charles Castle in France. And then we go into the next bit of history, which is the history surrounding John. John then goes from being the tax collector I mentioned already into being the king. Very unpopular king, upsets everybody, to the point where the Pope excommunicates him. And we think it's in that period that that's when Robin actually says, right, I'm actually going to get married now. This is when I'm going to settle down to marry him. And they go to Doveridge, and they settle down there, probably in the middle of the 6 years during which all the services in England and Wales have come to a close because of the excommunication. Mostly all the churches are shut down. Again, that is an international occurrence, and we can tie the marriage of Robin down to somewhere in the middle of that period. And then moving on from that, he's then got the whole thing that happens with John. You've got with Magna Carta, which is in 1215. At this point, Robin is married. He's got kids. He's not really, you know, he's taking, he's withdrawing, if you like, from public life more and more. Then, famously, you've got the loss of the treasure in the wash, and John dying, which he does in 1216. Coincidentally, it's then within 12 months of that, possibly, that Robin himself dies. We think he dies around 1217, which is not a popular date of his death, but I don't think he would have lived very much longer than that, because the point when he's dying is he's somewhere in the region of sort of 87, 88, maybe, years old. But then he dies and he leaves this legacy, because we know he has a son. It was traditional back then to name your son the same as yourself. So he then leaves behind a son called Robin Hood. And that's why you've got this Robin Hood character who then sporadically pops up again in history at a time period in the 1200s. But the original Robin Hood, the one we're looking for, I think we've tied him down, we've pretty much nailed him, like I say, between 1129 and 1217. That's his timeline. But he fits mostly into northern history.
One thing that interested me that you mentioned in the book was the age of printing, as it were,
yes,
when that came along, and obviously that allowed for widespread dissemination of all sorts of information in the form of books. And of course, there was a question about literacy then, just because the books were available doesn't mean that everyone could read. But one thing that you mentioned was about prior to this time, the idea of popular fiction as we know it didn't really exist. That is to say, the idea of completely making up a story versus taking something like what someone might have heard about this guy called Robin Hood and maybe embellishing it a little bit. But the idea of just saying, okay, well, I'm just going to make him just something completely other than, I'm going to make him a Turk. And what's more, I'm going to make him female or whatever, you know. So,
yeah, or stick a hat with a feather in on him and make him wear tights.
Well, yeah, there is that. And, you know, it's very different from how stories are handled, you know, these days. So I just thought it was an interesting wrinkle about how people thought about stories. It goes back to a point that I've made many times with guests about what we think of as myth. We think of it as something completely untrue, whereas for millennia, for peoples around the world, a myth wasn't something that was untrue.
No, yeah. Absolutely not. No, what people would do is they would get to know, over their lifetime, they would get to know traditional stories and traditional plots, and they would get to hear folk tales. I mean, take all the communication devices we've got now away completely, and it's word of mouth. It's travelling minstrels, it's bards. You know, it's the storytellers would get together and exchange stories and things like that because it was their livelihood, and they would move from place to place. And the only thing that changed is that they had no concept back then of dressing the part to look like the past. So every time they told a story, they would tell it as if it was happening now. And people in early Shakespeare plays and things like that would dress in the clothing of the day. They wouldn't attempt to engineer anything backwards. So you've got this weird dichotomy happening where the story itself could be, let's say, for example, you know, a Greek tragedy, and yet they're performing the Greek tragedy in Elizabethan dress because that's how they did it. But the content, the actual, you know, the background to it would have to have some kind of weight in history or weight in the classics. It would have to have some connection back into plausible history. Otherwise, the general population, who generally speaking know of these tales and know of these stories, they would smell a fish. They would smell that something was wrong, that it was fishy, that it wasn't right, that there was something in it that wasn't correct. So the idea that something just suddenly appears out of nowhere as a brand new concept, as a brand new story, extremely rare up to the age of printing that anything like that happened. I mean, it could even have been force of demand. There was so much demand for material to be printed that there is a possibility that they then started to tinker with it and tamper with it, and that's when you start to get things coming through. They tend to then merge legends together and pull in material from elsewhere, and from my point of view, where we are in history, you have a beggar of a job to tease the two apart. I've just finished a book on King Arthur, and you can't believe what an enormous cobweb of strands that's become, to the point where, I mean, when I did this book, I'll be honest, I drew a dateline of about 1650. Everything after 1650, I tended to only use if I was absolutely desperate. If I could prove that there was some kind of older provenance to it, I would use it. Other than that, I was sticking to material from the 1500s, 1400s, 1300s, trying to get back as close as I could. With King Arthur, I've gone even further. I've actually totally disregarded everything pretty much after Geoffrey of Monmouth, because the same thing's true of that period. Mm. As soon as printing cuts in and everything else starts to come in as baggage. And again, the same way that Robin Hood's material was obliterated by Dissolution of the Monasteries, by the English Civil War, and indeed, to some extent, by two world wars, because we've lost a lot of libraries that way as well, a lot of information. The same thing's happened to Arthur as has happened to Robin. It's the same, it's an extension of the same process. So yeah, they had this idea that there has to be a kernel of truth in it somewhere.
Did the Victorians by any chance have a, was there the dead hand of their reinvention? Did that get involved with Robin Hood?
Yes. The word catastrophic comes to mind. I suppose poetically and from a literary point of view, we look back on some of the giants of that particular age, some of the people that were producing literature and writing, you know, hugely long stories, hugely long works of poetry. You know, the arts really under the Victorians just exploded. But honestly, they absolutely murdered the material. If they couldn't find something, they would just make it up. So from a historian's point of view, a nightmare, an absolute nightmare. That's more drifting into the arts and, you know, it's for poets and people like that really to tackle the Victorian material. What I'm interested in, as any good archaeologist should be, is the origins, the sources, the oldest. You know, dig through the layers, find out what's at the bottom. That's kind of what I see my job as.
Going back a bit, you mentioned sort of Shakespeare plays originally being performed in the garb of the day. Was any of that to do with, or can you connect any of that with archaeology being a relatively young discipline? That is to say, I mean, would it have been very difficult for people, whether it was a playwright or an actor or an audience, to really know much about, for example, ancient Greece in terms of like how things might have been?
Well, archaeology as a discipline really only traces itself back to the days of the antiquarians and the grand tours. So 16th, 17th century, 18th century, more or less. Travel only really begins in the Elizabethan age, and then it gets a bit of a hiccup in this country because of the turmoil of the 1600s. And then people sort of in the 1700s, you know, from the Georgian period onwards, that's when they're really out and about and looking at things and recording monuments, and history becomes important, and the very first diggers are around at that time, although they're not archaeologists, they're more like treasure hunters. But then people then go around the world. You know, the opportunity as the empire expands, British Empire expands, and we get the Industrial Revolution, the opportunities to travel and explore just get greater and greater. Technology advances. That's really the birth of archaeology, I suppose, from the 1700s onwards. If you go back in time, if you were to, you know, watch Shakespeare or something like that, they'd use whatever props was available, you know. If he had a Scottish targe, you know, that was handy, they might use that for Macbeth with a dagger. But it could have been made yesterday. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be a medieval one. It could be just whatever was available in the props department. So no, they don't really have a concept of costuming as such. That comes in, again, round about the 1700s. It's a more modern development. So no, archaeology and history, if you studied the classics, you were aware of sort of what was going on, but it would be very difficult to contextualize that, to put yourself back. The idea of imagining what times were like back then, that's something, dare I say it, that really has its roots in the modern age.
Maybe just a closing thought or two here. I mean, in what you say about about all of that. You know, maybe it's just the fact that there are certain archetypes and certain motifs that come up again and again in human stories that keep getting drawn out, and it's those that stand out, and it almost doesn't matter if the dagger was made yesterday or what what sort of breeches that the actor is wearing. It's the events, it's the emotions that they evoke, you know. It's all that human drama that in some ways remains unchanged throughout the ages. And maybe that partly explains why Robin Hood as an archetype and what it lives on, and why the legends live on in our imaginations today.
Yes, there's an element in that. There's, I think it's come full circle. It's like once upon a time, the ultimate priority was the written word, the written source. It was the accounts of the original stories that really were paramount. Then you get to a position where it sort of floats away from that, and we've wandered now for several hundred years where we've been doing all sorts of other things to the material, if you like. And now in the modern age, with archaeology and history now as a discipline, it's gone back to the realisation that actually the original material is the thing that's really important. That's what's of paramount importance. I can give you a good example, actually, about Robin Hood's death, which is probably a good place to sort of round up on. There's this legend that was invented in the 1700s, the idea that he went to this place called Kirklees, and that, in fact, he was betrayed at Kirklees by a guy called Red Roger, Sir Roger of Doncaster, who was the prioress's illicit lover. And the prioress is supposed to bleed Robin, which was this medieval practice, to make him feel better. So he relaxes, she gets stuck in, you know, opens a vein to bleed him, and then just leaves him. So the whole idea that he's then murdered and he dies there, that actually goes all the way back to the 1700s, but it doesn't go back to the time of Robin. And if you look at it, I mean, there is this place called Kirklees mentioned, but somebody's just looked on a map and gone, oh, look, there's a place called Kirklees, that must be it. Oh, look, there's a priory and an abbey there, we'll have that, that'll do. But if you actually look at Church Lees, Kirk Lees, Kirk means church, Lees means in a woodland. So actually, when he dies at a church in a woodland. And I took great pleasure in mentioning this in the DVD. How many churches in woodlands do you think there were in the north of England at the time that he passed away? Well, hundreds, absolutely hundreds. It's not a place, it's a description, okay? So they kind of got that bit wrong. So then we went off, in the DVD we go off and we sort of start searching for different locations. I won't go through them all because we visited several different abbeys and priories and that were connected in one way or another to Robin. But the punchline really at the end of it, back to Skelton again with his play for Henry VIII, Robin's dying in the play and he actually specifies that he wants to be buried at Wakefield underneath the abbey wall. So we thought, oh, fabulous, Wakefield Abbey. We'll go and have a look at Wakefield Abbey. That must be where he's buried. Anyway, get the map out, have a look for Wakefield Abbey. There isn't one. There's never been an abbey in Wakefield, as far as anyone can tell. So we're like, oh, that beggar, that's going to make that a lot harder. What do we do? Then all of a sudden, out of the blue, like these things happen, happy coincidences, 2013, the archaeologists are digging away because they want to put some underfloor heating into the church in the centre of Wakefield, Wakefield Cathedral. They're there lifting up the floor, and they hit skeletons and an old stone-built abbey church underneath the church in Wakefield. And this is in 2013, Wakefield Cathedral of All Saints. So I'm thinking, wow, there is a cathedral, there is an abbey. There it is, that's the abbey. So I managed to finish the book just including this little bit about these skeletons that have been brought up. Because at the time I finished the book, I just speculated. I said there are obviously medieval skeletons, there's medieval burials there. Anyway, when the carbon dates came back, which eventually were announced you know, on the internet, blow me if they're not exactly contemporary with the dates for Robin Hood. So whether or not the archaeologists have got Robin Hood in a box somewhere and he turns out to be one of these three skeletons, or whether he's still there, I think he's buried underneath All Saints in the middle of Wakefield. That's where I think he is. Quite safely sealed below £1 million floor at the moment. You'd probably find him with geophysics. But I suppose the nice irony is that they've put a sort of a new altar in the lower part of the church, with this massive great knight's cross on top. The top of it is like a huge Templar cross, and I think that's pretty much sat bang on top of where he is. But there's a clue. I mean, if they find, ever find his burial, his last words in the Percy Folio, which is a collection of stories, he says, "And set my bright sword at my head, my arrows at my feet, and lay my U-bow by my side." So if an archaeologist out there has dug up a skeleton somewhere with a sword, a collection of arrowheads and the remains of a bow, can they phone in and tell me, please? If it happens to be under the Abbey in Wakefield, please let me know, because it means they've got him.
Well, watch the space, as they say. So.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, Mark, today we've been talking about your book, The Life and Times of the Real Robin Hood, and that's widely available. If you'd like to share with folks, I don't know, information about a website or anything that you've got coming up. Obviously, you mentioned that the King Arthur book, that's in the pipeline.
Okay, well, starting with Robin Hood, Life and Times of the Real Robin Hood, which is on Kronos Books, is available from Waterstones and Amazon. So you can order it, go out and grab it. It's well worth a read. The DVD is Lomax Pictures. So again, if you go onto the internet, type in Lomax Pictures, The Life and Times of the Real Robin Hood, you'll be able to buy the DVD. There is, in fact, a little known Facebook page for The Life and Times of the Real Robin Hood as well. I must stress here that if you type anything in and you want this book, the name Robin Hood is Robynhoode. That's how you'll find it. If you type that into your search engine, Robynhoode, you'll get the DVDs and the book, because we did that on purpose to make them easier to find. And I've just submitted the Merlin, Joseph and Arthur, King Arthur book. We're wrangling over the title even as we speak. I want to put the word polychronicon in there, which means a chronological history. The publisher's not so keen, because that's not a word that will come up on search engines. But at the moment, the polychronicon of Merlin, Joseph and Arthur has been submitted for publication, hopefully later in the year. So watch this space.
Splendid. Well, Mark, thank you so much for joining us once again on LegalizedFreedom.com.
My pleasure.